the biggest struggle for restaurants, which is in every single newspaper today, is profitability, margins, people closing down. It's in the newspapers. A lot of that is not because they have negative margins when they set up the business model. Like on paper, it should work. It's just in execution, it falls down.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back Connor Sheridan. Connor is the founder of Mad Egg, but not content with having one successful business, he's now started Nori, which has raised over $25 million to become the operating system for every restaurant in the world. Here's my chat with Connor.
Digitalization. What exactly is it and how can it transform your business? Well, the local enterprise office have you covered. Digitalization is incorporating digital tools into your business to improve efficiency and productivity, saving you time, money, and energy. It could be anything, from stock control to an online payments or booking system, and now there's a grant for it all. The Grow Digital Voucher helps businesses go digital and pay for those improvements that will make a big difference to the way your business operates. And the best thing about it all, the local enterprise office can handle it all for you. Any business from any sector with up to 50 employees can apply for the Digital for Business audit, and from there, they will give you a bespoke digital roadmap for your business. Once that's sorted, you can apply for the Grow Digital Voucher to help pay for those changes. Simple as that. So, if you want to make those first digital steps with your business to help save you time, money, and energy, talk to your local enterprise office today or go to www.localenterpriseoffice.ie/digital to find out more or click the link in the description below. Now, on with today's episode.
Connor, welcome back to the pod.
Good to be back.
Good to be able to welcome you back. I love, these are my favorite types. We're like November 2019, we chatted first.
Yeah, 5 years. Lots has happened, but it feels like yesterday.
Does it?
Yeah, genuinely does. Feels like, I remember meeting you down by Temple Bar. We were just shooting shit. But yeah, it feels like it's gone like that.
Really?
Yeah.
So to give people context, 2019, you had 3 Mad Egg restaurants?
2, just opening the 3rd. Yeah. Yeah.
And now it's all changed. You have a brand new company, not brand new now, but you have a second business. So bring me back to 2019 and kind of bring me up towards then kind of the idea behind Nori and why you launched a second business.
Yeah, for sure. It's 2019, if I can get back into the headspace where I was back then.
Right? Been a weird couple of years.
Yeah, for sure. Particularly for like hospitality businesses. So yeah, 2019, we were just opening our 3rd restaurant, which opened up successfully. We were going in to actually open the 4th in March 2020. And that was obviously a date in the calendar that everyone will remember.
It's burned into the memory.
Yeah. We won't spend too much time in the pandemic because everybody talks about it, but
it's weird, isn't it, though? Yeah. People either talk about too much or just have like PTSD about it and can't even bring themselves to mention it.
Yeah,
I talked to someone the other day and like they just wouldn't even consider the impact it has had on their business. They were business as normal. I was like, I don't think that works in 2024.
Yeah, no, for sure. But yeah, like it obviously pandemic popped in and put a bit of a dampener on growth for restaurants. So we pivoted to like online delivery type model as everyone else did. We're pretty successful at that. So we're able to trade through, then keep growing the business on the back end of it.
Because you had a really strong brand 2019.
Yeah, for sure. Like we were lucky.
Your brand was really strong. Yeah. Like it's not luck as in like you built it and it was a really slick brand. Your episode still gets referenced to me.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. People are like, that guy. Because you said something about like, you knew exactly. There's 2 things people reference. Even now, people will say, oh, my favorite episodes are this, this, and this. And your one keeps coming up because people reference you had the beats per minute of the music.
Yeah.
You knew. Can you just briefly explain that to people? And you knew how many knives and forks you needed per restaurant.
Yeah, it can be a bit. I like data. I like to be able to look at data, like which data. Probably feeds into Nori, which we'll run to as well. I think pre-restaurant. Yeah, I just think you're taking a huge leap away from working in a company to starting your own business. The restaurants were my first business. I think you try to de-risk all the things that are inside of your control. So you can't control how the customers will feel about the business, but you can control all the inputs. So I think I used examples to say, if you want to stand out as a restaurant brand, you need to create a really good experience. So people come to your venue to get away from the fact that they're stressed at work or at home, want to engage with family or friends. So we tried to create a good experience. And part of that was, what does the soundtrack look like throughout the day? And then with the beats per minute, it was like, how do you get people to feel a bit more bouncy or pumpy in the evenings, and potentially they buy more alcohol off you or they will just get a bit more of a better atmosphere and be able to engage more, and then you might do something a bit slower at other parts when the demographics are a bit different. So I think I mentioned maybe certain restaurants are in, say, shopping centres, so you're going to have a different style for families coming in versus maybe high street in the city on a weekend. People are going to go to your restaurant, then go out somewhere else. Yeah. You want to make sure you cater for that kind of atmosphere. And then, yeah, inputs around like knives and forks. You've got a really limited budget, right? We were setting up a venue and your CapEx is this number. It's not stretching beyond that. You need to have cash flow for 6 months of the business in case it doesn't work out. So you need to count your cents. So it's very much like, how many knives and forks, how many covers, if we wash these, how many turns can we do, what do we need to have, all this kind of stuff. So you just have like an input factor to go, every single euro is accounted for. Because you're trying to make that money back as fast as possible, right? To make sure that your investment is going to have a positive return. So that was my approach. I think I mentioned my business partner was a bit shocked about how anal it was. But
the devil's in the detail. I say this all the time. How you do anything is how you do everything.
Yeah.
And like people might say, oh, the music doesn't really make an impact. No, but it's the 100 other decisions you've made like that that make the impact. Because if you take that much care about what soundtrack it is, you'll care about every single thing. You'll care about the chicken. You'll care about the process. You'll care about how things are handled. I think that really is an indicator of like a really quality business, that you care. You actually care.
I think like I say today to the teams in both businesses, Nori or Matic, is I sweat the details. When somebody joins, definitely don't want to be like micromanaging people. You hire great people to be able to run functions or parts of the business better than you could. But as like a founder, as an operator, you're in the details because it's everything to you, the business, and the experience your customers get and the value you give is everything to you. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. So you want to make sure you're in the detail. And if you want to have valuable conversations with people, you need to know the details, right? So I think early on, when you are the person doing everything, you own the details. But then as the business scales, you need to stay in them.
How do you walk that line, right? Because that's something I think a lot of founders have fallen down on, is that they sweat the detail in the early stages. And I've done this repeatedly. You sweat the details a lot because you are doing everything. You know every rule because you've done it, right?
Yeah.
You've done front of house, you've been in the kitchen, you've done cleaning up. You know everything. You know all exactly how long it takes to do everything. I know exactly this with the podcast, so I know exactly how long it takes to do every single step. But how do you then handle the transition away from that? Because you can't stay there. Otherwise, you wouldn't have all these restaurants and you wouldn't have a second business. So how do you transition away?
There's a really good article called Giving Up Your Legos, which you probably pin to the show notes. I think it's really cool.
The title alone has got me. I've got a Lego tattoo on my left, on my right hand.
Yeah, it talks about that transition from being like hands-on everywhere operator to, if you really want to scale and be successful, you need to A, have the right people on the bus, and B, empower them to be able to take the business further than you can. So I mean, that's it, right? You ultimately have to understand like where your superpower lies in terms of where you add the most value. Stick there if you enjoy it. For example, certain CEOs or founders you've had on might be really focused on technology or product or sales, and they'll stay close to that and then build an operating team around them in other areas. So that's a big one, right? Structure around your own skill sets, bringing people who can take ownership, and then you need to trust these people, because if you don't let people run with it and make their own mistakes, which is the big fear, right? You're like, I know I can do it.
Yeah.
But if you hand it to somebody else, it's going to be rough. You just have to be able to get over that to realize the bigger picture is there's no really big successful companies that have one person doing everything, right? There's a reason why they scale out their executive teams, departments and everything else.
How did you do it?
Yeah, it's probably two things there. I think like from the restaurants, it was bringing an operating team who could be more on the ground around running different pillars of the business. So someone to run the people side, so the entire employee experience. Someone to run ops, which is, say, profitability and efficiency. Someone to run the back of house, so help run supply chain and menu management. And then you've got someone to run on the marketing side. So you've got the different pillars of the business and you're able to empower them with like strategic direction or goals and how we want to move forward, and then give them like advisory or coaching to do that. And then with Nori, which we'll probably get into a bit of detail in, it was about bringing in, as it's a slightly different business, it's like a B2B SaaS, like technology business. So you've got like similar-ish verticals. You're bringing senior executives to run different departments. You typically stand something up yourself. So for Nori, for example, I was the first product person. You're directing what should be built. You're the first customer success person. You're the first customer support person. You're the first salesperson. You're the first marketing person. But then as you start to get like traction and figure out like how this works, so you can start to bring people in to backfill that, like executives to build it out. I'll give you an example. You would have done the first million in revenue maybe by yourself because you figured out how to sell the product, why people buy it, what the best kind of buyer looks like, even if you're not a really skilled salesperson. And then you can bring somebody in to go, help me build a playbook for how to scale this globally, because this is your skill set. If I can't hire you to figure out, do people want this? Because that's not a good use of their time.
Yeah.
You're bringing in a specialist to help scale that. And then same thing with customer support. What does onboarding look like? Figure out a V1 of it. Do it, understand it, be in the detail, like we said, so you can actually understand the DNA of it, and then go, okay, this is working somewhat. I'll bring someone in to build that out successfully who's better than me, but at least we'll have an understanding of
this is a really, really important point.
So I think like
I've heard the story repeatedly of people bring someone in to fix it.
Yeah.
If a startup isn't working, can't get product market fit, can't get traction, and then they try hire their way out of it.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
That's a really important point you just made.
Yeah. No, 100%. I think for us, it was like you have to, like hard things are hard, right? You have to figure it out. Like you can't, 100% can't hire your way out of it, but different parts of the business, and it's not to say that it will stay like that. You bring in an operating team to help you scale, right? To help, they'll improve it, but they're there to take something that's working, albeit not perfectly. No startup is perfect. It's usually a mess behind the scenes, usually. But for sure, you don't want to bring someone in to figure out why your product isn't working, or people won't buy it, or these kind of things.
Bring me back to what you said there about hiring people in Mad Egg. You said you built out a people team, and that seems quite logical and obvious, and you hire good people and put them in relevant places. Why don't more companies do this then? Is it that they haven't got the margins to do it, that they're not able to hire it? What is it? Because this is the problem you hear all the time.
Yeah. For hospitality specifically, it almost became like an accepted fact that teams could be transient and the turnover of staff was super high. So in hospitality, you've got like 100% turnover rates in a lot per year. So for every team, you're kind of turning through it once a year. And there's a couple of reasons for that, right? Obviously, the industry, the kind of how a lot of the staff tend to be, say, working part-time, or they're studying, or they're doing other things, and they kind of age out of it or move on.
Yeah.
Other people are doing it for a period, not for a long time. So it wasn't always focused there. Like a lot of the kind of people function was originally like, say, HR or payroll. It wasn't, what is the employee experience? Like, what does your employer brand look like? Why would people want to work for you versus somebody else? What differentiates your brand? What can you give them that other people won't? And then what does that journey look like? Because we see the data in Nori that the turnover rate is super high, but you see it spike where people have not been onboarded properly. So that first 90 days, the experience isn't what they expected.
Right.
Like it's these kind of things. And it's becoming much more popular now, because previously it was like, we can't get people. Now you can't keep people in hospitality.
Okay.
So like, I think the industry has now started to look at a people function as something that is incredibly important. Like your employee NPS, how they feel about the business. Can you create a career for people? All these things are foundational to whether the business is going to be successful, because if you're turning over your entire team every year, you can't get any consistency in how you manage your operation, the guest experience, the brand.
You
brand
know yourself, equity. You win somewhere and you're like, it's a new person every time, and then the experience is very different. Whereas you win somewhere and if you're like a regular and you get like good treatment, you kind of, you develop a relationship with people in a restaurant and a cafe, and you, like, I will go out of my way to go to a specific cafe because I've got like some sort of relationship with the people that work there, and you feel almost involved. Whereas if you go somewhere every time, there's somewhere new, you're like, this is just too much hard work.
Yeah. And you feel that internally in the business as well. And then, yeah, carry that forward into Nori as well. You try to, like, I firmly believe in any industry, whether it's technology, whether it's hospitality, the only moat that you have is the people. Technology is eating itself so quickly that, like, you could build something today that is a big differentiator in terms of product value, but something's going to eat it tomorrow.
You see what AI right now.
Yeah, 100%.
Every day you're seeing something new.
So the biggest differentiator, defensibility to that is having a ambitious and mission-driven team who you can stick with them or they can stick with you. So
bring me back then in time. So Mad Egg to Three Outlets post-pandemic, say we're coming out of it. When did you get the idea for Nori?
Yes, it was in 2019 as well. So it's pre-pandemic. I think when we spoke last time, I had a listen back, which was interesting to hear yourself. So green.
I've done a couple of hundred episodes. Yeah. I try not to do it too often, yeah. But sometimes I do just to see where I should be improving.
Yeah, but I just wanted to hear my own perspective on business back then. And yeah, super interesting. But I mentioned something like you talked about I talked about being data driven. So I tried to build tools and systems for the business that were like analyzing, say, operational performance or profitability. And that was really the kernel of the product. So early on, I noticed like you can have a really good product for a restaurant, a really good brand, some great people. But as you scale the business into multiple venues, it really starts to stretch the connective tissue. And what I mean by that is, scaling a restaurant's all consistency. You need to have a consistent experience, consistent margins, consistent ops. But as you bring in like hundreds of people to help you deliver that with varying degrees of skill sets, decision making, particularly around how to run the business, can get a bit fragmented and a bit disjointed. And I found there wasn't a lot of technology in the market that was actually coaching or helping frontline teams to run a better business. It was more like, how do we digitize work that was done on paper or in Excel into like a mobile phone?
You saying to me at the time, there's all these different functions.
100%.
I'm kind of having a flashback as we talk. You know, you were saying there's all these different types of apps.
Different parts of
none of them talk to each other, and you have to use this for this and this for this. So that was kind of the friction point you're opening up against.
Initially, right, you've got all these people doing things in a business. I'll give you an example. You've got like people trying to understand demand in their business so they can better plan for what staff you have, or understand what food you should prepare in a kitchen, or what you should order from an inventory perspective, or when guest experience is good or bad. And you're logging into 7 different systems and none of it speaks to each other, but the data is not contextual or rich. It's just data on that specific job to be done. So we were trying to pull it together into the basic spreadsheets that I was doing initially with like different models and stuff like that to analyze it. And that was like the kernel to go, why is there not a system that it can actually really be a core operating system that takes all the mission critical stuff you need to run your operations in a restaurant, from like the behind the scenes, all the way from the people, the supply chain, to the profits and everything like that, and actually be smart enough to analyze the data and tell people or coach people what they should do day to day to make sure that they are actually making the right database decisions,
okay,
and they're actually controlling that consistency.
So not just a data entry thing, not just another thing to have to something that makes you smarter.
Yeah, we say internally in Nori, like, we don't want to be just another tool to do the work on, right? The idea is like, we want to be the source of truth or the operating system for a restaurant group or a restaurant to say, if I'm the CFO or the frontline worker, I'll go to Nori to understand how my business is doing, but what I should do next. So like we mentioned there, what can we do around guest experience? What demand can we expect? What chefs make in the kitchen? What should they order? What staff should be there? Those kind of decisions, but then also have all the other workflows that a restaurant needs. So like, maybe I'll just explain it a little bit. It's like, as a product, we classify it as an operating system, which means if you think about a restaurant like a P&L, we cover everything from sales, your COGS, down to your EBITDA, have all that data, but then cover all the workflows. So how you hire people, recruit people, pay people, communicate, staff them, performance manage them, how you manage your supply chain, speak to your vendors, how do you manage your menu management, profitability, ingredients, putting together all of that stuff into one platform. You're doing all of those workflows. So everyone in the business is working on it, whether you're a chef or you're a CFO.
Right, okay,
person.
So it all ties together.
All ties together. It's in one platform. And we're using AI models then across each part of that business to help them optimize. So the biggest struggle for restaurants, which is in every single newspaper today, is profitability, margins, people closing down. It's in the newspapers. A lot of that is not because they have negative margins when they set up the business model. Like on paper, it should work. It's just in execution, it falls down. And it's similar to what I mentioned. As you have transient teams or people who don't have operational experience or financial, a high level of financial literacy or data literacy, it can be challenging to run a really, really fast moving business. And we come in to say, hey, look, if we can put this system in, we can ensure consistency in decision making, consistency in profitability, and a chance to scale. So that's kind of the idea of the product. It's like a full OS, and then we're adding on things like lending, financing. So if you can help you be successful, then why wouldn't you open more?
So it's kind of like the large company from Ireland that were doing it for online retailers.
Yeah.
So you can see their data, you can understand it's a good business.
Mm-hmm.
If they can replicate this further, why wouldn't you? Okay. Why did you set up the second business?
Yeah, so good question.
to be a founder is tough. To be a double founder, I would imagine, is very difficult.
Yeah, I ask myself that question on a day-to-day basis. Why, right? What's the big why, or the compelling why? No, I think in 2019, the scale of my ambition was not what it is today for Nori, and the idea is not what it was today. It was like, okay, this can actually help me.
Okay.
And it can help.
You're scratching your own itch. You were like,
initially,
you were going to build it for Mad Egg.
Not a full software product, but the internal tools, and then speaking to other operators, like this can help them. And then speaking to operators, I have some, say, connections over in the UK. They were like, it'd be awesome if that could help us. And then you're kind of going, pulling out a thread to go, okay, this isn't just small mom and pop shops like Mad Egg with a couple of stores. There's real big businesses here that are struggling with the same problem. Because like from a first principles point of view, you need to get each venue to perform for a restaurant business.
And surely the bigger you get, like you said there, you explained it there, the bigger you get, the harder it gets.
Usually you just overlay like more people, more functions to kind of blow it out and control it a bit, but it doesn't work. So yeah, at the time it was like, okay, initially internal product to help us. There's something here. When you look at a market, you start to do some, you pull on a thread, you speak to people, you do some discovery. And then you look at like market dynamics.
You couldn't help yourself.
No, you just get into
the
data. You
couldn't help yourself.
Yeah, and you can see things like technology spend for restaurants as a percentage of P&L was super low pre-pandemic. It was like 2%.
Really?
So you're going like, this is a really A, underserved market, and B, like the penetration is low, and that can't sustain, right? Businesses have to evolve. And over the pandemic, there was an accelerator where we saw that almost double. So you could see businesses spending more and more and more on technology in various aspects of the business and becoming much more receptive to using technology.
Because there must be very few industries left that have such a low tech spend.
Yeah, 100%. So when I was seeing those numbers and then you're seeing it on the ground, you're like, there's an opportunity here. Like it's hospitality as a broader sector is like 8% of global GDP. It's not tiny, right? So it's a big market. And
at what point did you go, I'm going to build this beyond for myself?
Some of it was a bit fumbly, right? I think got accepted into, applied to the NDRC, the accelerator in 2020. And the first day was like, the pandemic as well, right? So decided like at an idea stage to do that, and it was like, okay, maybe this will help us or help me figure out if this is something worth pursuing or if there's a bigger opportunity.
You were just testing, experimenting.
Yeah, a little bit. Like I think, like if I'm being honest, I didn't go into it and go, I want this to be the number one restaurant technology company in the world. I want to go down a VC route. I want to build a huge international business. I want to scale this into all these countries and build this huge system. It was like, what is the logical next step to de-risk this or figure it out? Took the step. And I came from a finance background before restaurants, but I didn't have an overexposure to like raising funding or even building a tech company is completely different than building a restaurant. So I went into the accelerator, did some really good discovery, got some good coaching from the people there in terms of how do you validate an idea, what kind of hypothesis testing can you do. We got good traction in there, ended up winning the demo day or the primary startup to come out of that. And then you start to get inbound from VCs, first time you've ever spoken to them. You're kind of going, okay, well, hold on, let me try and figure this out a little bit first. And quickly realize like big opportunity, there, but this is going to, for us to really nail it, is like we need to have a really deep and valuable product that needs to be able to service businesses that are like Mad Egg or businesses that are doing 100 times the revenue. So there's a lot that needs to go into that from a development point of view. So I decided, like, if we really want to have a go at this, we go down the kind of VC route, which we decided to do. And then just one thing after the other, decided to, it kind of snowballed. And at that point, it was like, you're asking yourself, and you said why, I was looking to go, what is the scale of my ambition? Because I always wanted to build a really big global business. I always felt like I could, whether that's like naivety or not. And I looked at this business, I said, there's a huge problem. It's underserved. I feel like I know what the problem is and I know how to solve a lot of it conceptually. That's the easy part. The hard part is how do you actually build a company and a product after that? But that was like,
I think not enough Irish founders have that ambition though. I think Irish people in general, we do struggle from a lack of confidence, a lack of calling your shot, a lack of kind of going, yeah, let's have a crack and see if we can build a global business. I think it's getting better. I think it's definitely getting better as we get more exposure to other markets and more media. You kind of go, yeah, this is possible. Like, so it's interesting to hear you say that you felt you could build a global business.
Yeah, I think there's signal to that, right? I think there's, you, as I talked about de-risking, you're looking at the market, looking at the opportunity, looking at your own knowledge. You look at like all of those things to go, is there an opportunity? Is there even the tiniest probability you could do it? And then you need to have the conviction. It's interesting. I was at like a summit or an event last week where it was like a bunch of CEOs of similar stage companies to me from all across the world. Spoke to two guys, one from the UK and one from Germany. And we were talking about like, why are we, these specific countries, not competing with the US for, say, generative AI or some of these other bits and pieces. Like, I think even on an engineering front, he was talking about Germany used to be really far ahead and now they're losing out to different countries. And it all came down to the same thread that we all pulled, to say confidence is arrogance in a lot of these countries. To stand out and say, I want to do something great, can often be like seem as a little bit arrogant or seem as like, hey, no, like just like know your place a little bit. I think it's getting better, but for sure.
That's interesting. So confidence can be misread as
or conviction, right? I think like you need to have really high conviction to try and do something big. And I think then that can come across as arrogance. And I know myself early on as well, you put yourself out there, that's not a comfortable place to be. And some cultures, some countries are very good at that, to push that. The US is a prime example. And others, people are a bit more, stay within your own lane, right? I think that's kind of...
We had that chat on the couch outside. Yeah. I chat to some founders and they're not comfortable about putting themselves out there and either won't do the podcast, or if they do, they don't feel fully comfortable doing it. It is getting better. I think it's the biggest opportunity founders have, is to tell their own story, because that's what people connect with. I can see it in the data. You're a data nerd. You love this. I can see it in the data of when people sit down with me and do an honest, open chat and talk about their story, that the listenership goes way up. When people come on and just tell a really dull story about their company, and then we did this, and then we did that, and then we did the other, it just doesn't resonate because people can't connect with it. They can't see themselves. Like, you have to see it to be it. And people want to understand, okay, what did Connor do there? Okay, Connor was like that. Connor did this. That's what resonates with people. I think that's the future of marketing, is founder-led companies being able to tell their story really, really well.
Yeah, I agree.
When I look at you, and my question for you now is, you said something there about how you figured this out. It's just to take the next logical step. Mm-hmm. Common sense ain't that common, right? How did you learn that approach of just take the next logical step? Because I think founders have a tendency to get lost in the weeds of planning and planning and planning and not actually just take the next logical step. How did you train yourself to be able to take the next logical step and just keep taking the next logical step? Because to give context first, how much money have you raised now at Nori?
26 million.
Right. I think that's important for people to understand that, you know, you've built something very substantial in a very short space of time. How did you learn to take the next logical step?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. Some of it, it's probably like, if you have to look at your internal makeup a little bit or your own experiences, I think working in Working on finance is typically like you're trying to be like data led first, but you're also trying to have a logical set of steps to work something out. Example being trying to value a company. You have a model, you apply the model, it's steps to understand that. Try to apply a little bit of that kind of critical thinking. But then when you move into restaurants, you're literally operating week to week in a lot of instances. Like you have to show up every week, call your shots, be successful every week to have a successful month, every month to have a successful year. And it's kind of going, okay, I might have this budget or plan for the year or a growth plan, but I need to break that down into every week. What do I need to do to be successful this week to unlock the right to get there? I think that was a mindset that I had at the restaurant. So yeah, we need to like nail it every single week. And I think from an org perspective, like it's the same thing. Like we have a 10-year roadmap internally as a company. We have like an operating memo and it says we want to be the largest restaurant technology company in the world. What does that look like by revenue, by customers, by everything else? And you work back 10 years and go, where do you need to be over the next 10 years incrementally? And you just go, what is our next milestone? Unlock that, focus only on that, be successful there, earn the right to even think about the next stage because nothing else exists. It's just something that's in the ether. So you have to condense your time period to go
zoom out, then zoom in.
Yeah, to go, what do we think is the path to get there critically? And then how do we focus on the most narrow set of actions that we can control today to try and execute on that? And if you can do that successfully, you've earned yourself the right to think about a bigger picture because it might not be there next year for any business. So if you think too far ahead, you can have the really great vision and then a really messy middle where you don't know how you're going to execute and then nothing will happen, right?
I think that's so powerful because Barry Napier was on recently. He said almost the exact same thing. Roadmap up on the wall, now go work.
Yeah, 100%.
I think that's the beauty. I think a lot of people spend too much time developing all these plans but then don't have a plan for the first step. They can kind of, oh, we're going to do this. These are projections. And you're like, oh, Jesus. Without like the next logical step. I love that idea of unlocking the next milestone.
It's how we really think like internally. That. I think particularly in Ori, when we're running planning sessions or all hands or we're talking about progress, it's like, what is our next milestone? What do we need to prove to ourselves as a business to think that we can actually earn the right to be who we want to be in the future? And as the business changes, that changes. Like those, I think Mark, there's like a really cool or interesting quote from Mark Andreessen. He was like Andreessen Horowitz. He was one of the founders of Netscape. He talks about like a company being like an onion of risk. So at the start, it's just this giant onion full of risk. It's like, can you hire a team? Will people even want to work for you? Can you build a product? Does anyone even want it? Will people use it? You peel away that piece of risk. The next one could be, all right, can you get a product to market? Can you repeatedly sell it to people? Can you onboard people? Can they get the value? Peel away the under risk. Oh, can you now do it in a new market? Well, new people you've never met before want to use it. And so you're slowly going, like peeling it away until you get to a place where if you can keep executing, you'll have something good. You'll have something at scale. But if you think about the very middle of the onion when everything is successful, you'll never sleep because you're so far away from there, right? Like that's such a big journey.
And you got to understand what it is. So I think you've explained that beautifully. Now, you got to have a goal. You got to have a lofty goal because if you don't, and you've got kind of a low goal and that's the ultimate end goal, you'll never be motivated to go there.
No.
You have to be like, I obviously, I want to make this number one business podcast in the world. If you don't have that goal, and you know, I want to be the number one business podcast in Ireland, you're like, you could probably do that in 3 months if you really busted.
Yeah.
If you really went at it, you could probably do it. And then what does that mean in terms of revenue? What does it mean in terms of impact? What does it mean globally? Like you have to have a very clear direction. Otherwise, you're at nothing. Talk to me though about, so you started getting some VC interest after you did the accelerator day. How are you balancing your time? And this is kind of a bigger thing. We talk obviously about business, body and brain on this podcast. How are you managing your time between managing two businesses simultaneously?
Yeah, good question. Early on, like back then, it was still like ideation stage. There was like internal tools. You're learning whether this can be a thing. So it's like a side project. The main business is the restaurant business. And then as it evolves, you're looking to go, okay, like how do you... As it starts to build up a head of steam or traction over a course of whatever a year, then you need to start to put foundations in place to say, how can you actually operate both of these successfully? And a part of that is what we said earlier. What are the pillars of the business for that? Identify what the business needs to be successful in terms of pillars. So people, ops, whatever, product, go-to-market side or these things. And then you bring in people who can run it better than you can, even if you weren't doing both, right? Specialists, and give direction. So I think that's it in a real foundational way. But you need to have a pretty strong rigor around your operating cadence and your operating rhythm. So
talk about your personal operating rhythm. That's the thing I'm curious about, because a task will expand the time you give it.
Yeah.
If you were, you know, ideating on Nori, that could be all day, every day. Yeah. No problem. How did you actually do it though, day to day, going, I'm going to spend an hour on Nori, no more. I'm going to spend 8 hours on Matic. How did you actually do it?
Yeah, that's a good question. If you looked at my calendar, you'll see four different colours of every day into blocks. And
now we're talking. This is the detail I like.
Yeah, it's been there, been like that for years.
So four colours.
Yeah,
okay, break them down for me.
We'll have like different focus blocks. So some of it's like kind of creative, like expansionary thinking. Some of it is more operational or tactical. Some of it is people. So one-to-one management and these kind of things. And then other parts might be like BD, these type of things, like business development. So these kind of structures, and it's in blocks. Early on, it was days. So it was like some days it'll have a theme. So I would do work solely on restaurants on some days, Nori's on other days. And then it was you'll split the days and kind of move over and back into structure. But also like, that's the best way to restructure your own operating way of working. But that is like a byproduct of how the business is structured, right? So do you have an annual plan? Do you recalibrate that quarterly? How do you break up your quarters? Is it monthly? Who needs to be involved? How do you review performance? How do you weekly then calibrate the shots you're calling? That feeds in then to the work you need to do, because at one stage you might be saying, we need to go into a new market with Nori, and that will require more headspace than maybe something else. So that can change. But focus blocks have always been really important. I think my day is like my own personal operating system. Has been the same thing, similar to you, I think. You train same time every morning. You'll work on specific type of work. I know that I can do my best deep work really early in the morning. In the afternoon, I tend to do all meetings and communication when I'm probably most lively. Then in the evening, I don't do that, and I might do more tactical or administrative or like keep the lights on work.
Yeah.
So you try to block it into your own rhythm. Like, where do you feel well, or where do you feel?
I think that's really important.
Great. Like for me, I mentioned I had this conversation last week with those founders, and I talked about it like 2 years ago. I think I did an exercise like, what does a great day look like for Connor, or what does a good day look like for Connor? What do I need to do to perform? Like, I need to have time allotted to physical exercise, time allotted to thinking creatively, time allotted for connections with family, your partner, relationships, and some sort of progress, right? So you try to reverse engineer that into what gives you like momentum and carve out your time, because otherwise like you just get pulled apart. If you don't have really structured periods for when you're willing to do things, you're a busy fool, right? So I think...
And it's easy to do as a founder. Like, I love that, and I do the exact same thing. I always reverse engineer everything, and I've done that exercise repeatedly, and I do it quite frequently, going, what does a great week look like? What does a great day look like? Because if you don't know what good looks like, you'll never have it. You'll just be pulled and dragged and this way and that way. So I love talking to founders about like the nitty gritty of the day to day, because that's what it all is, right? Can you enjoy your average Tuesday? Like, can your average Tuesday be a good day? Because if it is, then Fridays will be brilliant, Saturdays will be brilliant, you know, when the sun is shining, it'll be brilliant. It's those days where you just got to get it done. That's why I love the specifics of a founder's day. You briefly touched on it there. How do you plan? You said yearly, quarterly, weekly. What does that look like?
Yeah. I personally, just personal and professional, and they're obviously intertwined. Yeah. I would set multi-year goals similar to the business. Like, what is my... what I want to achieve.
When you say multi-year, what does that look like?
Where would I like to be, or what would I like to achieve in the next, say, 3 years? So I typically go much further than that, to be honest. And then you try to work that back to go, what am I doing you have it on like a whiteboard, or if you want to use the American term of a vision board, right? You have it in your office and you're going, these are the things I want to achieve in 3 years. These are the things I'd like to achieve by the end of the year. And they're just staring you in the face and you're kind of going, okay, how do I bring that? What do I need to do this year to do that?
Huge part of that. Been seeing it. I think a lot of people do planning and then put it into their Notion or their notebook and never see it again. I'm a big believer. I have the same. I have it written up in front of me and every day I'll write it down on the top of my notebook, the top three goals.
100%. And working back, right, to go, what do I then need to do? When do I think I'll achieve this in the year? Or how will I achieve it? Is it first quarter, second quarter? What do I need to do to achieve it in that quarter, that week, that day? And then you make sure it's on your priorities list, as you said. If you have too many goals, you'll do nothing. If you don't have a clear direction, you want to achieve what you want to achieve. So personally, that could be a bunch of different things, right? It could be like family related. It could be personal growth, learning. It could be these kind of things, right? It could be fitness related. Like I mentioned, the races we're talking about outside. Set a goal to do 5 this year. And these kind of things. Like they're just something that you know is progress personally. And then professionally, it's milestone based, right? So I think it's, what is our next milestone as a company? And that could be a revenue target. It could be a next like round if you're going to run your business like that, or it could be like a profitability target. It just could be something that is important to the business, and then you're reorientating the business around what are all the different streams, what do we have to achieve to hit that milestone, how will we know we're done, what's the definition of done or success look like, how long do you want to get there in. So if it's 18 months, 24 months.
Okay, so you'll set a milestone and then an actual time period that has to be achieved.
Yeah, 100%. And then you'll work back from that.
Okay.
Because it's like what you mentioned, you can say, I'll work on this and it'll just stretch. Like it needs to be time bound, specific, like that kind of SMART goals.
And then SMART goals are incredible.
And then you're working back and you're going, what do I need to do to make this happen? Or does this company need to do? In the 2 years, and then what do we need to do this quarter to make sure that we earn the right to even get there? So you're working all the way back. Like I think in the companies, you plan like that. So yearly, annually, quarterly, and then we have what we call cycles. So you split the quarter into 6 weeks, snaps the cycle into 6 weeks,
okay.
And then weekly you call your shots. So it's like a Russian doll. You're working back from years all the way down into every week and every day, and you're trying to calibrate the momentum. You're just looking at it across all factors of the business going, are we compounding at the rate that we need to be to hit that milestone? And it's not just revenue, it's like product, it's people, it's customer, it's everything.
Because you're juggling a lot, like, and I love that phrase, are you taking tiny wins and tiny losses every day? Which is it? If you're taking tiny wins, they'll compound over time as long as you're compounding towards your multi-year goal. How do you decide what's important?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Professionally,
both.
Okay.
We're going deep.
Deep.
We're going personal, because I think one.
Yeah.
You don't have one without the other, right?
Yeah.
I think I'm really focused on body, brain, business. I think without the other, you know, the founder sets the tone for business. I can definitely see it in you and your businesses, how you talk about them.
Yeah.
You definitely set the tone. So yeah, how do you decide what's important in both?
Yeah, I think you need to. You need to look at, I said like early on, what is the scale of your own ambition? Like, what is your why? Like, what do you want to achieve in your life, right? That's, I think, how that'll be represented in your business and how you show up and how you structure your business. You need to be really honest with yourself and really know deeply what you want. Then you have your own set of values for how you want to operate, right? And I think that you have ambition and then you have a way of showing up. And I think that sets the tone for a business. Like, what are the behaviors that you want to show or you want to see in your company? And then only then can you really get people aligned and on what's actually important and from a direction of a business. So I was actually at a leadership course last summer, this summer in the States. And it was all about, it was a bunch of different ex-founders who had IPO'd companies and incredibly successful people. The whole thing was based on alignment, and the whole thing was based on understanding your personal orientation for what you want to succeed, making sure you're fully honest with everyone else. And if they also want to go on that journey, you have that early alignment, that kernel.
Okay.
And then as a company, what is the vision for the company? Are you being true with yourself for what you want to achieve? Is the work that you're doing every day actually linking to the vision? Like, are people all orientated and aligned on
I like
who you want to be? Like, everything from like your product strategy, your company strategy for how you think you're going to win, the why behind why you exist. Like, we talk at every all hands to be like, Nori exists to help an industry that's always in pain, right? It's always being reactive. They have, if we can help these businesses increase their profitability, grow, survive, we can actually change the trajectory of these people's lives. If we're successful, the industry should be able to grow, and we should see it being more successful. And you work down here. That's what's important. That's
it's
why,
clear and it's understandable. I'm not in the industry and I can get that.
It's why we exist. And then tactically, how are we going to do that? And what areas do we think are important to the company and the product and our customer to be able to achieve that? And what's important for us to be able to achieve that? So, like, how do we need to show up every day? How do we need to operate? How do we need to make sure that we deeply understand our customers' problems? We're actually building solutions for them, not just things we think are cool. We're actually having the impact we think we're having. We're taking feedback from people. So it's like that pyramid structure to go, what's the why? If you can keep people aligned on what's important for you and for the company, then you can do that at like a big macro level. You can do that then week to week, day to day.
When you take on external money, does that change the dynamic a little?
It's two sides of a coin, right? Like,
because you've done both now, so it's a really interesting place to be able to talk to you. It's very rare to talk to someone who's bootstrapped and then taking on significant VC money.
Yeah, it does. It's a completely different business. You run the business differently. You have to run them at different speeds. But you do that because what's your why, right? Like, it wasn't like you fell into it and said, oh, now I have to, now I want...
Oh no, where do these millions come from?
So now you have to run the business that, like, you're doing that to put a rocket on your back, to move faster, to compete with huge incumbents, bring in some world-class people. Like, you're trying to take a cheat code a little bit to accelerating that journey, because you wouldn't be able to do it otherwise, really, right? But it changes, like, there's two sides of the coin to it, right? There's... You take on capital and it's a commercial agreement, right? Somebody is investing in your company because they believe that you can return their fund or their or return an outcome. So like a VC for or venture capitalist, say they have a 100 million fund, they need you to at least exit for 300 million at some point because they need you to return the fund after dilution. So like it's, you need to be cognizant in that social contract that someone's investing in you, whether it's going to be through dividends, if you IPO'd, like best case scenario, or if you went profitable and decided to do dividends over 10 years, or you get acquired or something happens, you're committing to getting a return for that business. Equally, the people who join the company, everybody owns a piece of the company. In Nori, for example, everyone has equity options. So they all want an outcome. And they're open about it. They're there because they believe that it can be successful. Yeah. But they want to have something life-changing or else they wouldn't be there, right? That's a big part of their motivation.
I like when people are honest about it because so much nonsense.
Yeah,
tech.
For sure, right?
Oh, we believe in the big vision. And you're like, it's not really changing the world here. Like, let's be honest. Like, this is the important thing, is to everyone be honest. I love that alignment piece. I'm thinking about that still of like... And you can see that that straight line straight through your company. Like, and I think too often people go, oh yeah, we took on money and then it changed everything and then it all fell apart. And there's a clear value exchange.
100%. Like you go and you get like capital, you get support, you get this thing to move faster, to reach your ambition. Said at the very start of the podcast, like, want to build a big global business. You're trying to build a big product that's quite deep, needs capital if you want to compete. You need world-class people to come and join you, try and compete against some of the best companies in the world. So like all of those things is like, but you know that it's not like, nothing is free, right? You're doing it in return for like, to be able to exchange that value. So I think everyone in the company understands that. And I think that's important, right? I think it's important that people understand what route suits them. That's why I said around the scale of your ambition. Like, so, like, there's bootstrap business is the way to do it for a lot of people. Taking on funding is the way to do it for a lot of people. But you need to know why you're doing it and how it changes the narrative. Because
there's no one way to win.
But a bootstrap business doesn't need to grow multiple hundreds percent per year in order to, once you're on that track, right? Mm. You can slowly compound and do things. But you need to be cognizant that if you go on this track, typically within a 5 to 10 year window, the expectation is you're at a certain level. So it changes it from the speed of execution, definitely, but it changes the opportunity as well.
are you still involved in Matic?
Yeah. Yeah. yeah, look, like I think absolutely love the business and, yeah. and the brand. I firmly believe we're the best at what we do in that small niche of like farm to free range fried chicken, which is quite niche, right? But yeah, business has got an awesome operating team that are there. So it's day to day, not as close to it as I was when we first met. I would have been cooking in the kitchen when we were doing those podcasts. Mm. That's not quite the same today. But yeah, still involved.
You're still able to keep an eye. You're still able to straddle both, you feel.
Yeah. It's challenging, right? I think you talked about how do you manage your personal time. You can definitely feel stretched, like just push and pull. It's like anything. You go through periods of calmness and it's all fine, and periods where things might blow up or flux and you need to be able to manage it. But fundamentally, it's been set up in such a way where it operates really well as a business that it's and that's because of the people that are involved in the business more than
anything
else.
Day one, if people go back and listen to the first podcast, it's striking to hear the similarities between that and this. The fundamentals are there. Like the strong fundamentals. You talked about your body, so you train in the morning. How do you look after then the rest elements of your body and then your brain? So how do you look after your mental fitness, mental health?
Yeah, good question. A couple of ways. I think like what does a good day look like? So for me personally, there's a few things. There's, again, if you look at a macro and micro level, a macro level, like what's important to me as a person. So the relationships that I have with my partner, my family, like I'm spending meaningful time there because that gives me energy. What things take for energy from me that you can maybe not be involved in so much. Am I making progress in what's important to me in life with the personal goals? All of those things are important. Then more tactically, it's like, what does a good day look like? So I think I mentioned something where you're focused. Exercising physically is obviously really meditative as well as it is good for your body. If you can be in good shape, then you're much more likely to weather the storms, I feel like. I notice in periods where my physical health is super high, I'm way more balanced than periods where it's
your
not.
Your resilience is just through the roof. Like.
You're up and down a bit more, so being able to center yourself. And then that feeds into how you operate your business, right? Having control for me is really important in terms of time, calendar, and focus. If I feel like I'm reactive and I'm running around fighting fires, that's not a good way mentally either. So that's important.
So routine and structure are very important for
your
mental fitness.
I think like you look at like when you're running businesses, you're risk on, right? Everything is like, you look, you know, when you do your pension or you do something like that, to go, what risk level are you from 1 to 7? Your whole life is in 7, right? It's like the top right of the quartile. And you're kind of going, that's just like all like a roller coaster of everything. So okay. Everything around you needs to be, well, for me, needs to be so structured. Like whether that's same food every day, right? Within reason, or just simple stuff, or like training, like that walk to the office, like that periodical like structure, I think for me is very calming and same. Important. Yeah.
I like structure. I've built out like I went on holidays for a while there and just developed all these systems. It's like I've got them all anyway. Mm. I was like, let's like, this sounds so nerdy even for me, and it's like literally categorizing each one into like my fitness system, my recovery system, my nutrition cool. system. And then I had just it all like laid out on a page going, this is what I do. This is my nutrition system. This is my recovery system. This is my fitness system, down to everything. And it was so calming to do that because I'd been doing it anyway. I was such a creature of habit. Mm. I was like, I'm just going to have 3 different systems for each area, body, brain, business. And then just that's where I work. Because that's why I asked you about like, you know, where does one stop and one begin? I find I get distracted quite a lot. So like trying to narrow that focus so that I have very tight structures. And then
trademark that, show notes, body, brain.
Yeah, body, brain, business. That's what we're all about. That's kind of like, and that's how I like to like structure these chats, because I think
it's very cool.
I'm very founder led. I'm very much like, if you can understand what makes a founder tick, then you can help other founders. And I talk about the founder formula for success. If you were like giving yourself like a scientific formula for success for you, what would that look like? You're like, you know, this plus this equals success, or this over this plus this equals success. What would that look like? What are the key components?
Yeah, good question. I think that's unique to everybody, right? Like success is different for everyone. There's no one thing is not more successful than the other. I think it's down to what is your internal why. Keep going back to that.
What is success? That's why I ask it, because so many people ask me, go, what have they all got in common? I was like, everyone is different. So that's why I start asking this question, because I want to be able at the end of the year go, here's 52 formulas for success. Yeah. There's a lot of key things that look the same, but they're all different.
Hmm. Yeah, I think if I looked at my own personal definition of it, or what I wanted to achieve in a professional sense, it's like clarity. You need to have clarity, right, of back end scale of your ambition, but clarity on when you know what that is, then you can start to actually visualize like what that means. And then when you can do that, you can put it down on paper, right? You need a plan. So you need to know where you're going directionally. As I mentioned, you need to know that. So you need to have a view on like directionally where you want to go as a person or as a business. And the inputs to that are like being able to break that back into steps to get there, right? So what do you need to do from showing up, consistency, what you need to do across the business. If I looked at Nori, like our next stage now, for example, we have a really clear milestone where we need to be in the next 24 months. Like for us, we're de-risking certain parts of the business, and each one of those is a piece of success like that we will earn. And you're working back from each of those and going, what are the unknowns that we need to figure out? And then you're working that back to day to day, what do we need to do to figure that out? So I think, like, I know it's kind of a vague answer, but it depends on the goal. And for me, it's always about working back from the big, hairy, audacious goal all the way to what you need to do tomorrow to make sure you're moving in the right direction.
Overall in your life, say, what would be your founder formula? So if you were going to say clarity plus this over this, or clarity plus this equals success, what would that look like for you?
For me, it's the why, first of all, because I say it to anyone who I meet and says, oh, I'm thinking of starting a business. And I was like, why? Just much easier ways to make money. Just much easier ways to, I don't know, achieve professional success or kudos or all these other things. Like, it is really hard at any level, right? I don't think if you're going to do something that's considered a small business, it's consuming, life consuming. It takes all of your time. If you're going to do something that's considered like what you see in the newspapers and some of the guests you've had on where it's billions, consumes everything. You really need to know why, like have really strong personal conviction. And if you have that, that will then feed into the resilience, the consistency, how you show up, how you weather the storms. That's the most important piece, like the why behind why you're doing it and why it's important to you to do that. But that's because you're broken internally, or you've chipped in a shoulder, whatever the reason is, or you just have a...
Do people know though? Because I often ask the people that as well. And sometimes like, they don't know, but I pick it apart as we're chatting. I'm like, I see it now. Like they're running away from something, or they're running towards something.
Yeah.
Or they're an addict.
Yeah.
They're addicted to the game.
Yeah.
Which commonly most founders are. Do you think people know? What do people say to you about the why?
It can depend, right? I think like with someone, everyone has different reasons, but I think Outside in, I'm not sure people realize how difficult it will be. It's not something you just jump into it at a really, really compelling why. Some people do. You can meet people and you can see it in their eyes and you're like, this person has whether it's just like they want to change an industry because something happened with their family or something close to home, and it's become like this obsession. And it's like you can see it's obsessive way of thinking. Other people, because they're really driven by a financial outcome, whatever their why is, or they have a chip on their shoulder because maybe they didn't achieve what they wanted to achieve early on, or these kind of things. And they have this thing where they want to show people what they can be, and you can hear it in the way they like speak and that energy, but you can see it in the progress.
You can feel it.
Because it's usually like, you meet somebody and they'll talk about it, and say you meet them 2 months later, the ones who are really understand and obsessed about it will have done something. Something will show progress. The other ones will just keep talking about it. And then you're like, I don't know, the idea of it, as opposed to the idea of actually jumping into it, right?
Do you want to do it, or do you have to do it?
Yeah.
That's kind of how I think of it. It's like, if people are starting something, like, are you all in on this? Is this something you have to do? You're going to do it regardless of what anyone says to you. They're the best ones. You can feel that energy. And we'll move on to our quickfire round now shortly. But talk to me then about Nori, because we've kind of like pieced together the early stages. Give me like a whistle-stop tour then on the last 18 months of what's been happening, because it's been, every time I open LinkedIn, you're there. Yeah. Worse than me.
Yeah, sure. Founder marketing, right? It's been a wild ride. So like we properly started to formulate the team like 2021, right? So it's about 3 years, just over 3.5 years to today. Last 18 months, we spent probably the first year and a half really building out the product. So as I mentioned, recovering like big allotment of bases across the restaurant. So it was about 12 months building out that part of it, getting early feedback, testing it with different cohorts of customers. Started to commercialize last year, mostly in the UK as our first market. Launched with some small kind of chains or small restaurants. And then over the last 18 months, really scaled that out into some real international players, really large businesses, entered into new markets. So testing with customers in the US, entered into the Middle East, entered, obviously getting pretty good penetration into the UK. I think on our beachhead for next year, we should probably have between 12-15% of the market. Wow. If we can keep growing at our rate now, so of
that's
that beachhead,
seriously chunky.
So like really getting deep there in the area that we know we want to serve, and yeah, so it's obviously then the capital rounds. I think within 12 months we raised 25 odd million, which is good injections to help us do that. But it
especially
comes with,
now,
yeah, it comes with big expectations. And I think at this stage we're really in an evolutionary point this year. So from this summer, I feel like you have to, in a tech company, you have to build a product. That's your first milestone, right? Can you build something, get it to market? Can people get value out of it? And you can't think about anything else. So people ask you why you don't have a HR team, or why you don't have an internal development, or why you don't have like L&D, or why you don't have an internal finance team, or these things. It's like nothing else matters than if we build this, get it to market, people see value, and can this be a thing?
Without that, there's nothing. Can have all the fancy functions in the world. When I see small startups with all these mad things, swag for this and swag for that, and they're at every conference, I'm like, oh no.
We used to be internally, we get a lot of questions last year to be like, why don't we have this, this, and this? And I just, every meeting was like, nothing else matters than just doing the thing and making sure it works. And then once you've proved that, now we're going into an evolutionary stage where we're trying to build a company that can actually scale. Like, so you're building in different departments across the business, different execs to run the departments. We've internationalizing, so all the complexity that comes with that. So we're really trying to figure out, like, how do we go from early traction, going deep in like a decent sized market in the UK, to a real international player over the next 18 months. That's just a net new thing, right? You're trying to figure that out. You went from being like, can we actually do this? Will people buy it? Will they get value? Can you repeat that? And now you're trying to figure out to go how you actually scale the business out into multiple markets and really get real scale, which is the billion-dollar question for everyone, right? So it's been exciting, 12, 18 months. Particularly last 12 months just has been a wild ride.
And then as like... We've talked about, I'm not going to talk about it, belabor the point about how difficult it is for restaurants at the minute and bars and cafes, but like, ironically, you're solution becomes more important then as times get tougher. Anything that gives you that edge, that sharp edge, is becoming more important.
It's a tough one, right? Like, I think I met someone today who I was interviewing for a role, and I asked him why the hospitality industry, what's his passion for it, and he's like, he'd worked in hospitality companies, and he's like, I don't know if I grew up with a passion for it, but I was interested with it. And then I got into the problem space and I became obsessed about it. And now I love it. And now I'm passionate about it. Right? And he's like, what is like the steps? It's like doing anything like a fitness or you're looking at these
kinds
of things.
It's levels to everything. Yeah.
Like when I operated in hospitality when I was younger, and then you look at it, okay, this is an opportunity for a business. Then you set up Mad Egg, and then you become obsessed about it. And then you love the industry, and then you want to help it.
But you either go one or two ways. You become obsessed, you're like, I absolutely hate that business. You're never going to hear it again.
Yeah.
You know, you go one or two ways, and the people you want are the obsessions, right? Yeah. They're the people who are like, this is just, I love it. I think about it when I'm not thinking about it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and I'm on the other side. So like, love the industry, obsessed with trying to help it, and obsessed with trying to help my own businesses in it as well. And like, it's definitely been a challenging period. I think like the input costs have never been higher to run these kind of businesses. Consumer preferences are changing, right? People want to use delivery, people want to use other platforms. Everything's kind of eroding the margin in an industry that has pretty low margins as it is. So the headwinds facing the industries are tough. The tailwinds facing the industry is people are spending more time isolated at home, working from home, away from their peers. It's probably the last bastion of like connective tissue that we'll have is that sector, outside of things maybe like fitness or these kind of things. So I think we'll always have a really important place in society, but it's going through a stage now where we're trying to figure out what will it look like for the next 20 or 30 years, because what worked 20, 30 years ago doesn't work anymore. People don't operate in it. The business model doesn't work. So it's really going through this like period where it's going to have to reimagine itself. And It will, and it's and it will come back out.
Everything is cyclical, right?
Yeah.
We always think this is the new thing. This has never been seen before. When in reality, when you trace things back, everything is cyclical.
Mm.
Everything's happened before in a version of a way.
100%.
If you're getting your crystal ball out now and kind of looking at the like the restaurant cafe industry, where would you see it in the kind of like the next 24 to 36 months? Like, are we having a reset and then everything will kind of come around again in a different form, or what way would you see it being?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? A lot of it can come down to policy as well, not to get into government talk and things like that. Like you look at different markets we operate in. So look at the US market, it's growing double digits, 11-12% a year. They reckon every year is going to be a net new peak in terms of food service trade. So while there is challenges, they have good kind of federal policy to be able to make sure these businesses can scale. Look at the UAE or the Middle East. Different market, but it's growing like 18-20% year over year.
How come?
Some of that is like net new location, influx of people, people doing like nomads, lifestyle arbitrage, moving there. You're seeing they want to be the biggest hospitality player globally.
Right.
You're seeing that with like different sporting events. In the US, it's just the nature of the beast in there. Look in the UK and you look in Ireland, it's been a bit more flat in terms of growth rate, almost like a net negative in some instances. Mm. Like you look in Ireland, it's like planning policy, can you get access to units, these kind of things, can we get enough infrastructure to get enough people into the hotspots to actually service the businesses. So potentially there was too many venues for certain areas, and we might see a drop off in certain parts of it, and then it'll get more competitive potentially. But yeah, 24-36 months, depends on the country. I think that we'll see a bit of a shake up domestically in different types of businesses. You've probably seen that in the press recently.
Yeah, you see it already,
things are happening, and that's a pity, right? It's a lot of great businesses there, but it'll change the model. I think I used the example of businesses will need to be like more like Henry Ford in the kitchen and the back of house, like a logistics business, and then out front they'll try to be experiential to differentiate. Mm. Like, how do you give the guests what they want? But we'll see like a change in the operating model of those businesses. So like be less people heavy in a lot of instances, more narrow offerings.
Do you think things shift out from the city centre? Do you think people are more towards the suburbs now? Is the work from home thing kind of like made the city centre a very difficult place to operate in?
Maybe, but like we work with like a lot of restaurants, and we can see the trading patterns, and the ones who are in Dublin city centre are the best performing across the board.
Still. Wow, that's interesting.
In the right parts of the city,
right?
With the concepts that are maybe, as you said, cyclical, that are more in vogue. The problem with like going out to suburbs is because the planning policy is so tight that there's such a limited number of licensed venues, the cost to actually operate in the suburbs is not that much lower than the city centre, with the exception of rates.
Okay.
You're never going to get as much footfall in a suburban town as you're going to get off Grafton Street, right? And you're not actually paying that much of a difference, which doesn't make sense, right? Mm. I think that the cost will need to drop in terms of the cost of doing business there for that to make more sense.
Okay.
So what will change? I don't know.
Let's get on to a quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur should read?
Good to Great is probably one that I've given to a lot of people, from Jim Collins. So he's written books like Great by Choice, Good to Great, Built to Last. And the whole idea is like he analyzed 30 of the most successful businesses in the world, or 30 businesses, and analyzed why were some successful, hyper successful, and some were just good businesses. And he breaks it down into 5 inputs, which is like the different inputs into a great business, around like the people, the leadership style, the organizational structure, and really charts out like what you need to have to be a great business, and uses data, which is like something that I'm...
You're a fan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'd recommend that for any, because it's great for early stage, late stage, just super cool.
I like that. What's something you'd learn the hard way?
Something I learned the hard way. If something from, I'd say if something, like listening to your gut a little bit, I'll give an example. When you're starting a new business, sometimes something isn't the right fit, right? You know, it's not the right fit if it's It could be a customer that's not a right fit and you want to please it, and you spend all your time, your team's time and the energy and the focus on the 2% versus the 98%. And that's just like, that's a specific example, but it goes for a lot of things in terms of hiring or other people. There's definitely have been instances where you make a rash decision versus because you feel like you need to keep moving versus actually taking a more considered step. And I've been guilty of that for sure.
It's hard. Sometimes you're like, is that my gut or is that my fear?
Yeah,
not sure. Which I had that yesterday. I was like, my wife, I rang her up and I was like, oh, I got this opportunity. What should I do? And she goes, I listen to your gut. I'm like, I can't hear it.
So it's rumbling.
But then I calmed down. I literally had give myself an hour or two and I was like, no, that's not the right opportunity.
Hopefully you're listening to the pod and you're feeling inspired. Maybe you want to do new things in your own business, or maybe you have that brilliant idea you've always wanted to bring a little bit further and see if it works. So why not right now? You listen to the majority of the guests in this show, and they've been helped by the local enterprise office at some stage in the journey. They have something for everybody. Whether you have that idea you want to develop, you want to get your products to new markets, you want to innovate your existing products, or you want to expand staff and premises, they have the supports to help. So why not today? If you want to start up or grow your business, then contact your local enterprise office today.
What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Success inverted commas, right?
So success is open to interpretation. Yeah, exactly. That's why I ask it so openly.
Yeah, for sure.
And it changes. It'll change for you in 2 years as it does now.
I'm joking. Is there like a lot, I would say. This is back to the why piece when I speak to people. Like if you're going to really want to build something, any business, you have to be obsessive about it, which means it consumes a large proportion of your life, your waking hours. That means that it will eventually, in periods, degrade other parts of your life. So how do you balance, like, can you be the best son, partner, brother, business partner, boss, friend, all at the same time? That's tough, right? And I think you go through periods where you feel like you're not being that best version of yourself for other people, or quality of your relationships can decline, and other periods it gets better, time for yourself, all those kind of things. So I'd say it's cyclical as well. Yeah. There's periods where that for sure.
It goes back to what you said about knowing yourself.
Yeah,
for
sure.
You have to know what's important and you have to be able to maintain it at a certain level. Mm. I think it's the people that let everything drop completely will struggle in the long term, because then it's very hard to pick things up.
Yeah.
If you break something, it's very hard to glue it back together 5 years later. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
Good question. Probably give it to wider family, extended family, very close-knit, like wider family of like aunties and uncles who've supported our family and lots of ups and downs and other things like that, and direct family. So probably that.
Such a wholesome answer. I was hoping you said buy a Lamborghini.
No, I don't think so. Wouldn't suit me.
I'm going to give you 1 million euro.
Yeah.
And you have to invest it in one person or one company. It can't be yourself. Who is it?
Good question. Probably a friend of mine, because I get good value out of his business. No, I'm joking. So Raul Irma. So he has a company called Cambridge Spark, which is training people how to learn machine learning skills, data science, generative AI, how to actually scale up, irrespective of your background. So if you came from a trade, if you came from a service industry, if you come as a trader from a hedge fund, he helps train people to get them ready for the next evolution of the workforce. And I think like that's a really cool idea, just because it's making sure that you can bring people along for the next journey and they can really be at the front of the value capture that will come with this next round of technology. And you can see that, like, his business is growing super fast.
Cambridge Spark, bro. Yeah. Deadly, must look that up. If you were starting from zero again in 2024, what business would you start?
Nori. If I couldn't choose Nori.
Can't choose Nori.
Can't choose Nori. I'd do something in the longevity space. I think getting older, start to like do more periodic like health checks or scans or things like that to see like oil changes, as I call them, to see how you're actually getting on. And I think very hard to even get the data from them and see how you're progressing. Everything is like conversational and piecemeal, and you don't really know I find that for people, you don't know until too late, like if you're actually operating in one way or the other. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there in so many different avenues to be something that I would look at.
I'll be your first investor in that. I am so bullish in that space. Yeah. I'm a longevity nut. Get my bloods done every 6 months. NAD infusions, really, yeah. Telomere testing.
In Ireland?
The whole shebang, yeah. But again, it's hard to do. I've got in with a guy very early, 5 years ago. But now it's so hard to do. It's so hard to get in with them. It's so hard to get these services. And again, it's quite piecemeal when you go beyond that. People are like, oh, how do you do that? And people are afraid. So I think that is probably the biggest area I'm most bullish on. So yeah, I'm in with you on that one.
We'll chat after the show.
What do you believe other people would find strange or strongly disagree with?
Interesting one. This is going to sound so cheesy. I was like, first thing that came to my head there is like, hard things are hard, right? Which is more like, if you want to do something really difficult, it's actually going to be really difficult. And when you break that back, I often find when you meet people and you're like, you want to build the biggest technology company in our space, that is just words, right? But to actually do the thing is so hard, or else a lot of other people would be there. And then when you get into the day-to-day and the brass nuts of what you need to do and sacrifice and commit to be able to do that, even for myself, like, is so much that goes into that. I think people understand running a business is difficult, but I don't think they understand that. It's not even running it, but it's like being part of that journey of how difficult it is, how hard it is, and how much it actually requires and will take from you. It's easy to say the words, it's very hard to actually do it.
And we live in a soft world that's dominated by social media, where everyone just throws out things and then it's like, oh yeah, great.
Slogans and stuff.
And they don't actually explain it. That's why I love doing long form, and I'll always do long form, because you get into the weeds, you get into the nuts of what does your day look like. Like, people can understand that better than, well, I got up early and exercise. Okay, that's giving me 1%. It's the other stuff that goes into it. Yeah, I agree. What has been your worst investment?
Worst investment. Probably goes back to what things you learn the hard way. I think early on when you're trying to start things up in any business, you can go down a rabbit hole because it's a shining light. I used the example of like time spent with like customers that weren't the right fit or something, trying to change someone else's business in there, and you can burn a lot of time and other people's time. So I'd say something like that, right? I think anything that you're going to commit a lot of your emotional focus and time to, when it's better spent elsewhere at real critical points in business, is probably the worst time.
So worst, wasting time with the wrong kind of customers.
That instance early on, because like I've actually seen, and we were lucky that like early on we had a couple and we moved away from them, thankfully. But I've met other founders who've built their entire business around difficult customers, roadmaps, they're completely locked in.
That's what they assume the customer was.
Yeah, and they'll have someone that's the loudest voice in the room and you'll follow that thing. And that can actually destroy a business or take them off track for
100%.
And I remember going into the business saying, I would never do that. And then you get into this place and you're like seeing the traction and the momentum, it's easy to fall in. And
you don't know what you don't know. You don't know that's bad. You don't know that that's not the norm. That's only through experience and through being honest. What's been your best investment?
Best investment. I have to say Mad Egg, right? Because if I didn't take the jump out of the job to do that, nothing would have happened. Propelled everything. Taught me what it was like to build a business. Yeah, definitely that.
It's funny how I think it was Steve Jobs said the dots connect in reverse.
Yeah.
So now you're looking back on, well, Mad Egg led me to here and led me to building this massive company. What's your final piece of advice for founders listening?
I don't know if I can give advice, right, everyone? But
give me a quippy thing that'll go well on TikTok.
Well, go well on TikTok.
Follow your dreams, son.
I said this phrase like 5 times today, I think, in this podcast. What is the scale of your ambition? And I feel like I'm a parrot repeating it, because I went to a talk with Rolf Botha, who's the head of Sequoia, the managing partner. He was the CFO of PayPal, helped IPO it. And the whole thing was about, what do you want to achieve? What is your ambition? Everything else in your life will come down from that. Really honestly understand that. Because once you know that, that'll determine how you build your business, how you run it, how you show up. Everything else backs in from that. So I think like, even if you're at the very start or you're halfway through the journey or you don't know where you are in your journey, answering that question will point you in some direction. That would be a good direction.
That is the title for today's podcast. You saved me a job in a few months' time.
All right, sweet.
Where can people learn more about yourself and then about Nori and Mad Egg?
Yeah, for sure. For the restaurants, madegg.ie. And we're around Dublin City Centre. So
where are the outlets? Someone's listening right now.
Camden Street, Jervis Street, you know, Jervis Street Shopping Centre, Dundrum Shopping Centre, Liffey Valley. So if you're around those areas, drop in. Hopefully you enjoy it.
You go to the Dundrum one, it's excellent.
Very good. For Nori, N-O-R-Y, not the Nori with the seaweed wrap, .ai. You can find out about it or on LinkedIn. That business is... yeah, most of the updates are on LinkedIn. If you're a restaurant business or you want to shoot the shit, feel free to reach out.
Perfect. Connor, thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, cheers for having me, Gary. Appreciate it.